I hope somebody knows how to catch the sound knob up there a little sooner now that I've interrupted and exposed somebody being asleep. Don't just come to me with the camera. You come to me with the sound. So, Reggie, you want to go up there and wake up whoever that was that didn't turn the sound up? I'm not in a very good mood tonight. That's why I interrupted before 7 o'clock. I had a choice today of interrupting my message and stopping and throwing the mother with her two boys out. They're good people, regular people, voices of faith. And a dad who should have been there. I don't care what excuse he's given. With what looked like a very immature, I'll take the parent's word that the child was 12 years old. Boy, 12. Girl, 14. And the boy, unacceptable in his behavior in our church. Now, I want all you parents to understand, your kids are not allowed in the cathedral until they're 12, which gives you 12 years to make sure they're not juvenile delinquents, or you will go out with your kids. Not acceptable. I have zero tolerance for psychologists. Zero tolerance with modern yuppie child raising techniques. Zero tolerance with today's delinquency and gangs. Zero tolerance with parents who don't recognize that God put butts on kids with adequate padding to be used before they get big muscles. And I have zero tolerance for child abuse. But God's word said, spare the rod and spoil the child. Not allowed in the cathedral. I commend the parents on their response. I made the choice not to interrupt the message and embarrass. And I commend the parents on their response. And they said they would handle it with their kids. But fathers, don't send your wife with kids that she can't control by simply looking at them and saying, you better not move again. I'm the guy that tore the asteroid out of John Ashcroft publicly when he was a teenager in Central Assembly in Springfield. I made such a law and order man out of him. He's a nightmare of the nation today. Turned it into his profession. But I blame the ushers more than I do the parents. Now, you ushers had better wake up. I've noted something. There's a revolving door on the front row and the front of the church. You earn your right to sit in those first five rows in the church. You earn it by performance. You earn it by the radiation of your attitude in the service. You earn it, and I determine who gets to sit up there in the front. You don't. I just tore the head usher apart before I came in here for deciding that you're going to put people up front for reasons that you've come up with. I don't need people sitting on the front row with the life that we try to get into the service for the world to hear and see as an inspiration for the message, that if they were given a chance to keep time, would dance like that guy that went out of the Lakers to the Timberwolves. What's his name? He's Stanford, man. I'm sorry for that. Man, he dances like a monkey with four broken elements.
Mark
who? Mark Madsen. Yeah, Mad Dog. He dances like Mad Dog. I mean, you know, I need a little inspiration to preach, and when I see some scarecrow jerking in the wind sitting on the front row, I want to kill, not preach. Now, you ushers had better figure out, if you've got the brain in your head of a squirrel, you don't sit a woman with two kids, one of them a new 12-year-old that has not yet passed muster, proving that he's been taught how to act in the cathedral. You don't sit them up front. You don't sit them within eight rows of the front. Ushers created the problem. And I'm about to name the one that did it. I've had to deal with him a half a dozen times. You can't drive him away with a cannonball. You can't hit him with a club and make him leave. But he says, yes, sir, and he doesn't get it. He hasn't got it, so he can't get it. He's a soft-spoken, gentle, yes, sir. Tell me I'm wrong. Looking at you right behind that camera. You know who it is.
Yes, sir.
Soft-spoken, smiling, gentle. He couldn't tell a cocker spaniel to lay down and it would do it. He's a nice guy. But he's not usher material. You can tell him what to do, and he'll, yes, sir. He's going to do what he wants to do. He doesn't get it. Now, we have this paradox. I need people to step forward, and yet the standards are going to stay high. We'll figure out where to fit you. This guy should be in the back corner of the parking lot, where he can smile at people when they get out of the car and look like he's security. And his faithfulness can perform a scarecrow function. Do you know it's war on Sunday morning? Now, the mother said she was disturbed. The father wasn't there to help her. She was disturbed. But she thought it would make a greater disturbance if she got up and took her kids out than if she sat there and suffered through it. Well, now, I want to give you, all you parents, a formula. I don't care what I'm preaching about, what part of the message it is. You got a kid that's acting up, you stand up and say, excuse me, Pastor, I'm taking my kids out to teach them how to act in church. I will then have the congregation applaud and probably get so anointed I'll preach another hour. Now, you got that formula? You got a kid that's acting up, you stand up and say, Pastor, excuse me. I'm taking my kid out and teach him how to act in public. And I will say, if you've got two of them, do you need me to take one of them by the ear and help you lead them out? And then I'll keep on preaching. I haven't said anything in a long time. But there, I don't want to look around, there are some cowardly members of the church that saw that woman with her kids that should have just walked up and said like an usher, follow me, and taken them out. Don't make me do it from the pulpit, because when I do, they won't recover. I want it understood. We are having a church grow up within a church. I've never had it. I won't have it. I will not tolerate Don't talk to me. If you've got kids with attention deficit problems, take them to a psychiatrist then. Take them to a doctor. We're not an ordinary church. I will not let your incorrigibles perform on the red seats of this cathedral. You get your kids under control, or you stay home with them, or put them in a reform school. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Well, I'll take my kids and go. Goodbye. I'll take my money and go. Double goodbye. Now, do we understand each other?
Yes, sir.
You can play this as a pastoral nugget periodically. I won't have to address this problem again. But you ushers better find a brain. And you that are in charge of the ushers better supply a little brain power to them. Kids from 12 till they come of age sit with their parents, not discussable. If you've got any brains, when people come in, you can tell how the kids are acting. If they aren't walking respectfully at their parents' side, you've got a problem. Don't put them on the front row. I want to address this again. I'm too old to help you raise your kids. I raised you spiritually. Now you figure out how to take care of your kids the way I take care of you. If you don't get them before they're 6 years old, you might as well forget it. Now this lovey-dovey, yuppie father and motherhood. You make the kids get up off of their ass and stand when their mother comes in the room, you might have some kids that are worth something. Now get ready for festival. Give me some music. Go on the telephone. I want somebody to argue with me about this so I can really blast you before 7 o'clock. We are live tonight.
Yes, sir.
Later. A couple hours from now, we will take you into the cathedral for a service, but this is our time. All week long, as I say, every Sunday night at 7. All week long, from 10 to 11 every night here in Los Angeles, we're on. My wife sings a song, I teach, close with a song. Great teaching every night. These 4 hours I use to pastor my congregation. Now, being a carnal congregation like they are, probably most of them are watching the Lakers. They were losing the last time I checked. So you need to just give it up. If you're a fanatic, you don't need to watch them lose. So I want to find out. I want to find out if anybody is watching me. And, you know, we used to buck these playoff games in Sunday afternoon. Now, we're having to buck it during our lifetime in the evening. Well, that gives me a chance to pastor the people that really care about this ministry. You promised me this morning you would make your reservations today. So I'm throwing the phones open early. Make your reservations for the cathedral next Sunday. You can't get in without a reservation. And the reservations need to be by Wednesday noon so we can mail them to you, the passes. So get on the telephone. Well, you're doing pretty good. We're running right now, by the way, with all volunteers upstairs. Now, before we went live on 56, I came and interrupted, and we went live, and one of the staff members was asleep at the switch, and the camera came to me as I interrupted, But the guy that was there was still talking, because the man that's on sound couldn't get himself alive. Well, we're waking him up, and we have nothing but volunteers. A volunteer directing, a volunteer on sound, volunteers up. Isn't that wonderful? We're getting there, folks. Now, get back on the telephone. Now, I've been known as you longtime watchers to just get up and leave an empty chair here if you don't perform. This 30 minutes is dedicated, and it's expensive airtime, to us being here with a house full of voices of faith to take your calls, to make it easy for you to get through and make your reservations for the cathedral. Do it right now. Now, we're looking for 300 volunteers committing 12 hours a week and building a church within the church. Of those who want to take this step of faith, I'm up to 208. That means 92 more will have the 300, claiming the promise of Judges 7:7. By the 300 will I save. So why don't some of you that have been mulling that over make your commitment tonight as we see this number grow on toward 300. 300 that volunteer 12 hours a week. You call us, give us your phone and address. Only regular members of this congregation need apply. If you haven't been participating, you're sure not going to keep a commitment of 12 hours a week. I don't need strange volunteers that don't even come to the cathedral. This is for our congregation this hour. And I need 92 more of you to step forward. So you got plenty to do on the telephone. Secret 16, we've not yet reached our goal there by any means. So get on the telephone. We got 5 more minutes in this half hour. I would like to do some teaching in the next half hour, but I want all the reservations in. Need about 200 now. And I'm up to 209 toward the 300. That means 91 more to go, committing to be one of the 300 volunteering 12 hours a week. So just keep using the telephone. Get on the telephone. Sunday morning in the cathedral, we're preaching through the book of Romans. Message number 246 this morning. Now, Paul wrote lots of letters. He founded the church at Galatia, a Celtic colony, granted a kind of independence in the Roman Empire. Celts. Now, you remember Jesus said, go first to the lost tribes. He knew where they were. I got a message here I got earlier. I want to read it. This is from Yuma, Arizona. I just love your intelligent approach to Christianity. It's so stimulating. I've gotten so that I don't want to even talk to some of these so-called Christians, because when I share some of your more provocative teaching on the pyramid and the lost tribes, I get looked at like I have two heads. And they miss the whole fact of seeing God's hand and control on history and the opportunity to increase our faith. Keep teaching it right. Galatia was a Celtic community. Macedonia, Celtic community. And when Paul wrote to the Galatians and wrote to the Philippians, he's writing to Celtic communities. When he writes to the Romans, he's writing to a Celtic community. The church at Rome, founded by the daughter of Caradoc, married to a Roman senator, that in the last chapter of Romans, Paul identifies Rufus, and he says, greet the mother of Rufus and me, my mother and Rufus' mother. Now, when you know anything about law, you hear some redneck tell you for parking a fender bender, he's going to take you to the Supreme Court. You try it. Yeah, technically it's a privilege to get to the Supreme Court. Not that easy to get there. You go through lower courts. You think that just any old jaywalking loony at some far-off city in Rome, or the Roman Empire, rather, can say, I'm going to appeal to Rome, I'm going to appeal to Caesar? Paul had contacts. Gladys was later adopted by Claudius and became Claudia. And the British Silurian King Caradoc, called Caractacus with his Latin name, never defeated by the best generals that Rome could send, betrayed by a woman, marched through the streets of Rome as a domitar, a gift to Caesar, having been betrayed and captured, made a speech to the Roman Senate that Tacitus, the Roman Latin historian, records in his annals, that so moved the Senate that instead of being slain, which was the normal procedure, he challenged the Senate, saying that history would not be able to record their treatment of a general they'd never defeated, showing mercy to one that had fought them as a hero. History gave them a chance to show their treatment of someone that they had adequate respect for what he had done to resist their best efforts. And they gave him house arrest and let him get a stipend from the Silurian kingdom in the area of Glastonbury. You go to the hide that grants the property to the Glastonbury church in the Doomsday Book and the records of titles and deeds, to use modern language. You'll find Rufus there as a centurion sent by the conquering Romans. That's where he met the daughter of the Silurian king. Joseph of Arimathea converted Gladys and Linus, her brother. Caradoc, having house arrest, getting a stipend from the Silurian kingdom, it was his household that was the Gentile church, or the home of the Gentile church in Rome, to which Paul was writing, as I'll show you in the 16th chapter when I get there. Traditions make void the word of God. Rome forever fought the Catholic Church at Rome, the medieval church kingdom forever fought the truth about the church in the south of France. They didn't want the world to know that those that were closest around Jesus in the household of Bethany founded the church in the south of France. They didn't want the world to know that Lazarus was the first bishop of Marseille. They didn't want anything that would compete with their supremacy. The split between Orthodoxy and the Eastern churches, Greek, Russian, Ukraine, all the Eastern churches of Orthodoxy, is because that the Orthodox Church would grant primacy to Rome, but not supremacy. And Rome demanded supremacy. In the earliest annals of the meetings of the bishops, British bishops occupied the key place, the Celtic Church. These Celts were the prominent depositary of the gospel in the early days. Paul tried to go to Asia. Common sense says that's where the population is. An angel of God turned him around and sent him to Macedonia. And he's writing with particular messages to these other churches. Usually his letters were occasioned by some problem in the church. Romans is his magnus opus. Romans, he's writing to a church he didn't found. And as I said, when I come to the 16th chapter, I'll blast the traditions that refuse to recognize the names and the persons of those that he greets at the close of the letter, that he names them one after another. There have even been attempts throughout the history of the Bible to close Romans before it gets to the 16th chapter. Romans was his masterpiece, where he laid out his whole philosophy. And when I finish Romans, you'll be able to go back and read his other letters and understand them better. But in Romans, he pulls everything together. So don't fault me because I'm trying to pull the whole Bible together in 29 years of teaching here and hang it on the pegs of the Roman letter. As I go through it, I intend to sweep all of the teaching of 30 years and the whole Bible into this Roman letter. And right now I'm in an excursion on praise as I have come to the point where he's condemning the song of praise to oneself. That which Paul would not allow and which God doesn't want is self-righteous, self-praise of our righteous performance. He does it all. And as Paul said to the Corinthians in a specific case to a braggadocious church, I'm going to read that, which I've read the last two Sundays. There is a kind of boasting that Paul and God's all for. 1 Corinthians 1, last verses of that chapter, to his problematic church. He wrote actually four letters. And the Armenian Bible includes one of his letters to Corinth that's not in our King James. No flesh should glory in his presence. Kalkisitai. Same word that in Romans 1, where I'm camping out, he condemns boasting in self. No flesh should glory or boast in his presence. Of him are ye in Christ Jesus, who of God is made unto us everything, wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. Some people boast in their wisdom. Some boast in their righteousness. Some boast in their sanctification. They ignore the redemption because you've got to be in pretty bad shape to need to be redeemed. And most people don't want to accept that. According as it is written, he that boasteth, literally, glorieth it is in the King James, let him glory. He that boasteth, let him boast in the Lord. That's what we're doing in the services at the cathedral now. Boasting in the Lord. And I hope that the joy that seemed to infect the service at the close today spreads its infection through the congregation. I said to my wife this morning, there were symptoms of revival breakout at the close of the service today. Let it go. I've been there. I've been there, and some of you haven't, so let it go without the idiocy that has turned people off. This church is going to move into a dimension of praise. And I just want to point something out. A few people have noticed it. You know we passed May 23rd? I think it's remarkable that God would lead us into boasting in the Lord. Shove that in the devil's face. Just like that. Come. Yeah. Now, you may be seated. Some do not some do not know who watch them live long enough. But some many, many years ago, the devil thought he had silenced this ministry. He thought he had silenced it before I came here. God sent me to restore the church with his help to faith. But my obituary on television was written in every news media of this city about 16 years ago, thereabouts. Scott's last hour on television was the headline. Been a long hour, hadn't it?
Yes, sir.
That was May 23rd. And every May, it seems, the devil comes back to attack. And there have been some struggles going on behind the scenes. I didn't want to give him a notoriety. But he got whipped again. And we ended May with a note of praise. Isn't that wonderful?
Yes, sir.
Just like the devil had to face when God raised our Lord from the dead and began this Christian covenant time where for faith God does everything. You know, you're looking at a picture of the mobile studio. Every Sunday, the way we bring the cathedral service to you live is that mobile unit has to be fired up at King's House 1 and driven down. And we have volunteers who do that. In fact, many of you have been praying for Jerry's wife. She's doing well from the surgery. I got reports tonight. But he said as he took his wife to the hospital, I'll keep my commitment. He drives that truck, threads the needle and pulls it in there next to the cathedral every Sunday. A crew of volunteers, mostly, set everything up for Sunday, dismantle it after the service on Sunday, and back it goes. We do the service in that production truck. Microwave connections take it to our antenna farm at King's House 1 and shoot it up to the satellites, send it out on the internet. The various shortwave stations pick it up off satellite. A lot goes into producing the service at the cathedral. Volunteers make it happen. And all you're asked to do is make a reservation and get your ass there. Pretty simple, isn't it?
Yes.
You can sit home and listen, just like everybody else. You're there to make a testimony to the worth of God's Word and what it means to you, and to provide an inspirational setting for the message to go out to the whole world live. And back it goes to King's House 1. We're in a studio now at a different location in Glendale, King's House 2. And the signal is sent by microwave to King's House 1, and up to the satellites, and out to you. Every square inch of the globe heard the message today. So much for May 23rd. We went past it on the run this year. So get on the phone and rejoice. Come on, get on the telephone. Now, what you're watching on television happens every Saturday night as we close off the parking lot, exclusively ours, for 15 years by resolution of the city. The alley is closed off by special permit. And every Saturday night, volunteers and staff gather and go through that routine to hook the mobile truck up to cables that are... And that was not an easy job. Strung under the floor, and according to fire code regulations, everything in place. And then Sunday after the service, immediately, they reverse the process, put everything back in the truck, drive it back to our original home sanctuary and the antenna farm at King's House 1. Every week, Volunteers and staff are down there Saturday night, long hours, and Sunday afternoon to make this broadcast possible. Well, it seems a pretty small thing to me that others of you whose lives have been changed, who rely on this teaching for all of your Christian progress and in your hours of need, to dedicate the 2 or 3, 4 hours on Sunday to get to the cathedral and like soldiers in their place. It becomes a commitment you won't waver from. You make your reservations and you get down to the cathedral on Sunday morning in the heart of the city as we keep that flag of Christian witness in the heart of the city of this city of the angels. All of this is designed to take the message around the world. We're 24 hours a day off satellite, 24 hours a day on every square inch of the globe, shortwave, multiple frequencies at every place that you go, 24 hours a day live on the internet. The heart, Sunday morning, where the message goes out from the cathedral, and we expect the congregation to be there. 29 years, you've come to expect me to be there, and I'm there. Rain, shine, hospital, whatever. When I'm far away, even by remote. Now, get on the telephone, make your reservations. I need about another 180. So come on, get on the telephone. Not all of you people that are just tuning in, having been watching the Lakers. Serves you right, the Lakers lost by 18 points. Serves you right. Maybe if you'd watched me in parade, you might have won. Yeah, that'll teach you. So put your brooms away. Ain't going to be a sweep. Settle down to business. And you that just tuned in have been watching the Lakers, call up and apologize and make your reservation for the cathedral next Sunday. You need to do some penance. Get on the telephone. Okay, no more calls. I want to talk about something. In the earlier hour, I mentioned the Celts. And you know, I can tolerate ignorance that's recognized. I have zero tolerance for people that are too dumb to know how ignorant they are. And I'm really intolerant of people that substitute traditions for the Word of God. Jesus told his disciples to go first to the lost tribes. Now, what a stupid order 1900 years ago, if they didn't exist somewhere in the world where you could go to them. Now, people have been looking for the lost tribe for years, trying to find some Jews around some little oasis in India or the Arabian desert, wearing beanies and carrying scrolls and keeping the Sabbath. And I'm tired of ignoramuses who want to put me in the camp of the British Israelites. It's a bunch of nuts. Richard Brothers, who started the British Israelite cult, claimed that he was the true King of England, demanded the throne, and they put him in, right, quite rightly so, committed him to a nut house. And that legalistic British Israelite cult was the devil's substitute for the truth that so turned evangelical Christianity off on the subject that out of fear of being dubbed a British Israelite, which is a cult, they wouldn't even deal with the question of where and what are the lost tribes. Now we have hours on top of hours of teaching on the network that replays periodically. But I decided tonight I'd just ask some questions. Inductive reasoning tells you that even if the disciples didn't know where the lost tribes were, and God was ordering their behavior, you probably could get a hint by the places they went. They went to Celtic colonies. I did a research paper when I was at Stanford, because research was just really hitting respected academic circles. The Celtic cauldron that traced history clear back to the family of Noah, the digs among the Celts in Switzerland and Central Europe that for the first time was uncovering the high culture of the Celts. They were dubbed barbarians by the Romans. Boy, talk about a pot calling a kettle black. The Romans dubbed them, and I mentioned earlier, the church at Rome was a transplanted British royal family in the city of Rome, the family of Caradoc. Read your history book, you know-it-all critics out there. The first pope was Linus. He's in every ancient line of the popes. Linus was the brother of Gladys, who married Rufus, the Roman senator, changed her name to Claudia, and was the British princess in the Roman court. And Linus, her brother, who was converted by Joseph of Arimathea, those members of the Silurian kingdom that were converted by Joseph of Arimathea, Linus was the first pope. Out of that Christian household from Britain, and it was a British heritage king, Constantine, who Christianized the empire, and it was Helen, British lineage queen, that opened up the return and the research into Palestine. So read your history, folks. And as I said earlier, British bishops held the most honored ancient seats in the earliest church councils in the West. A Jew, by name, can be anything you want to call it. There are various definitions of a Jew in today's world. But etymologically, the word did not exist until the prophecy that had been uttered on not Solomon, but his son, when Solomon died. The kingdom would split. Jeroboam to the north, the so-called ten tribes, and Rehoboam to the south, Judah in its territory, Benjamin's territory, which included Jerusalem, that David had made the capital, and the Levites, who had no property allotment, who would serve in the temple. The kingdom split in a dramatic prophecy where a prophet rents his garment into 10 parts, 12 parts. And divided the 10 from the 2. The kingdom would be divided And with the death of Solomon, the division occurred. Jeroboam said, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem, as he united the northern tribes. And he set places at Dan and Bethel and set images there. And the kingdom divided. When you read in the Old Testament, you have Kings and Chronicles, historic records of basically the same time span. Kings is the record of the northern kingdom, alternately called the Kingdom of Israel, alternately called Samaria, alternately called the northern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin. And there were clear up, this was the heart of the rebellion against David and the ability of Absalom to gain support from Judah. They resented the movement of the holy capital from Hebron, the burial ground of Abram's family, to Jerusalem, which was in another tribal territory, Benjamin. There were those that resented that move to Benjamin. But when the kingdom split, Jerusalem remained the capital of the south, and the northern tribes split off. And the citizens of the southern kingdom, alternately called the Kingdom of Judah, alternately called Jerusalem for its primary city, alternately called the southern kingdom, they're fighting all the time. And the citizens of the southern kingdom, Yehudi, were called Jews the first time when the northern kingdom joined with Damascus to fight the southern kingdom. And the name crops up as they are fighting against the citizens of the southern kingdom as Jews, in the Hebrew, the Yudahi. It's the first use of the word Jew. You can call it anything you want. Hebrew, Ibari, means stranger, nomad. Abraham came to a strange land. His descendants were called Hebrews. Jacob had his name changed to Israel, and his descendants were called Israelites, alternately. All Jews are Hebrews. All Jews are Israelites. Not all Hebrews are Jews. Abraham had many children. Not only have Ishmael and Isaac, he had seven sons of Keturah. Hebrews were descendants of the ultimate Hebrew, Abraham, or Abram, whose name was changed to Abraham. Jacob had his name changed to Israel. So all of his descendants, which is a separate line, doesn't include the Ishmaelites or the Keturites and all the other descendants of Abraham, those that were descended through the line of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, who carried the birthright, all Jews are Israelites. Not all Israelites are Jews. Israelites included the northern kingdom. Jews were the citizens of the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom was carried away years before the southern kingdom fell. The northern kingdom was conquered by the Assyrian king, Sennacherib, and his successors, and he transplanted the whole population with just a few remnants remaining, transplanted them east of his capital at Nineveh to be a buffer between the Medes, which is northern Persia, who were rising up and contesting the Assyrian dominance of the area. He just moved the people wholesale, settled them south of the Caspian Sea, south of Lake Van, as a buffer between the Medes of northern Persia and his kingdom, left just a remnant, and then transferred non-Israelites into the area, and then taught, got sell-out traitorous priests to come back and teach them the ways of the Israelite religion, and that's why to this day the Samaritans are hated by the Jews in the biblical time. Israelites were moved out. South of Lake Van, south of the Caspian Sea, in that area where Armenia became a nation. Now, ironically, you trace the history of Armenia. The Armenian people began as a separate nation, same time frame and date as when Sennacherib planted the northern kingdom in exactly the area occupied by Armenia today. Chew on that a while. Where do the Ashkenazim Jews come from? As they, with Jerusalem falling, were dispersed through the nations and still dispersed. The Sephardic Jews come out of Spain primarily, where they became servants of the royalty and thus allowed to live because of their money management and other abilities as they served the royalty in Spain. That's the smaller portion of today's Jews. The Ashkenazim Jews come out of the Khazarite kingdom primarily. During the Middle Ages, when the Inquisition was slaughtering Jews, and the Muslims were slaughtering Jews, legend has it the king of the Khazarite kingdom asked representatives of each of the faiths, Christianity, Judaism, and the Muslim faith, to come and talk and discuss with him, and he converted to Judaism. And like the Yemenite kingdom to the south that has produced some of the scrolls that we have with the great scriptorium because the king converted to Judaism. The Khazarite kingdom was a Jewish kingdom that thus became a vacuum into which the Jews fleeing persecution found a refuge, and they settled in the Khazarite kingdom and intermarried as those who were transferred by Sennacherib into the area of modern Armenia today. They intermarried. What's new? When Joseph went down to Egypt, his two sons that become the leaders, Ephraim, the leader of the northern kingdom, and the leader of those tribes, they're half Egyptian going out the gate. He married the daughter of a priest. The bloodline can be followed, and the Ashkenazim Jews are the result of intermarriage in the Khazarite kingdom, and they populated northern and central Europe and are the largest population of the Jews in the world. But it all begins with the division of the kingdom. You read about in Kings and Chronicles, the chronicles of those kingdoms. Why do we have 1st, 2nd Kings, 1st, and Chronicles? Chronicles is the record compiled by the southern kingdom, Judah. Kings is the record compiled by the northern kingdom, Samaria, Israel, northern kingdom. That's why you read of Elijah's exploits in the Kings. Such a dominant figure, you read Chronicles, it says very little about Elijah. Chronicles is the same time frame, but the focus is like if we wrote the history of the Americas, and Chronicles by analogy would be a history written from the United States of America's perspective. First and Second Kings would be the history of the Americas written from Canada's perspective. These, you're reading the Bible, like read the Bible through in 92 or 2002. You wonder why you're reading the same things. You read it through Kings, and then you start over again in Chronicles and read some of the same events. Two different historic perspectives. And when the northern kingdom fell, the king's record was completed by scribes in the south. But they represent two frames of reference of history. Now, you that want to find the lost tribes somewhere, they've got to exist today. Because Ezekiel, who's prophesying of the last days, he sees a Valley of Dead Men's Bones come to life? A typical picture of a resurrected kingdom? And then he's told to pick up two sticks. This is a last day prophecy. And he's told to pick up the two sticks. What are these? Write on the name of one, Israel. Write on the name of the other, Judah. Is that in the Bible? Let me show you. Go to Ezekiel. Want me to continue? You better get on the telephone. Now, you can finish the calls you're on, but then don't take any more. Ezekiel 37, the prophet has been shown a valley of dry bones, and they raise and come to life. And God says, this is the whole house of Israel that I'll bring together. And then, the word of the Lord in verse 15 of Ezekiel 37 came again unto me, saying, this is a last day prophecy. Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions, because some of the northern kingdom were a part of Judah. Then take another stick and write upon it, just like their Canadians that are here in the United States. But Judah was a nation separate. Take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, the son who got the promise, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, all the house of Israel. Join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. And when the children of thy people shall speak unto thee, saying, wilt thou not show us what thou meanest by thee? Say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand. I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. Well, only a dope or one who doesn't believe in prophecy would say that both those nations are not existing and can't be found by God in the earth. They both exist. Now, Ingersoll, the great atheist, said the Bible can't be true because the promises of God to Abraham, to his descendants, the Jews, have not been fulfilled with the Jews. The Jews are not a people that are analogous to the sand of the sea and stars of the heaven. There's a few million of them by comparison to the billions on this earth. But they haven't become as numerous as the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens. They haven't become a nation never to be defeated in a major war. They haven't possessed the gates of their enemies. They've been locked behind gates, possessed by their enemies. So Ingersoll concluded the Bible can't be true. God never made that promise to the Jew. And there are two verses, two chapters. Most of Christianity is avoided out of fear of being called a British Israelite. Genesis 49. God said to Abraham that the promises given to Abraham, which include those I just named to you, would not go to Ishmael, but go to Isaac. God then determined that the birthright, which included all of those promises, would not go to Jacob's or Isaac's first son, Esau, but rather would go to Jacob. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. Most of you that read the Bible know that. In the promise given to Abraham, when Abraham asked God to, how would he know that the promises would come true, God gave a test of truth that boggles the mind statistically. This is how you'll know that these promises I gave you are true. Your descendants will go to a land where they're strangers. They'll come into bondage in that land. And in the fourth generation, I'll bring them out richer than when they went in and bring them right back again to this land. Statistically, that couldn't occur, but it happened. They went down to Egypt, became slaves, and in the fourth generation, which is why the Pharaoh who believed prophecy was going to kill all the boys, God led them out with Moses. They came into the land just as God said they would. But before they left, Jacob, dying, faced the same thing that Isaac faced, of to whom of his sons would the blessing go? And his oldest firstborn, Reuben, which by primogeniture rules would be the primary candidate, had become so evil as the devil got to him, Jacob, under God's guidance, is going to hand out the birthright, the blessing that is the conveying of that which will go to the ones that will fulfill the promises given to Abraham, some of which I just named. You read it in the 49th chapter of Genesis. He passes the birthright by choice under God after adopting the two sons of Joseph. And Joseph tried to get Manasseh, his oldest son, in the primary position, and old half-blind Jacob crossed his hands and gave the primary promise to Ephraim, the sons of Joseph. Now, to Judah, he says concerning Judah, 8th verse, Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise, and that's why in the book of Romans, as the second chapter comes to a close, Paul is talking to Judah, saying you need to seek God's praise, and you'll get God's praise if you follow what he's writing in Romans instead of the praise of men. But they always expected praise from men because of this. But the primary thrust of the promise to Judah is the 10th verse. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh, who is a type in another passage, and there's cross-references in most Bibles, the type of Christ coming, and unto him, the Messiah, in other words, unto him shall be the gathering of the people. Judah is going to have the scepter, right to rule, and be the maker of laws, lawgivers. You ever wondered why there are more Jews as attorneys than any other single group you can think of? I mean, how many Jews are in the legislature making laws? I mean, everywhere you turn. I mean, we have 15 attorney firms on retainer. I think 14 of them are Jewish firms. God keeps his word. He goes through the other promises and gives to the various sons their portion. He comes to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough. Even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall, which means they're not going to be contained. They're going to spread out. They talk about their battle prowess. And then they say, from thence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. I don't even really want to talk about that. But he gives the blessings of thy father shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that was separate from the brethren. So he gives to Joseph the birthright, having taken a part of it out and given it to Judah. Judah got the right to rule and make the laws. Now let's go over to Chronicles. I just want you to answer this question. I'm going to answer for you now. You have to find the teaching on the internet page, which lists all the teaching you can get. Go to the Chronicles letter, 5th chapter. First Chronicles, chapter 5, page 526. I'm in trouble with my Bible today because a glass of water fell off on it before church this morning, and the pages are sticking together, but I think I've saved it. Now, I want to ask you a question. Would the United States be prone to elevate Canada above the United States unless there was some higher force or truth that compelled them? The answer is no, it's rhetorical. Why would the scribes of the Judah kingdom to the south want to promote the northern kingdom? They wouldn't. But listen to this. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, which is Jacob by his new name, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. And the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the primogeniture right of Reuben as the firstborn, because it was given. The birthright was given. Read it. His, the firstborn Reuben of Jacob, his birthright, which included what Esau wanted back, what Isaac got and Ishmael didn't, what Jacob got from Esau, and then through trickery, the mother of Jacob and Jacob got the blessing from Isaac, and Esau wailed and cried, but what I've given, I've given. Now at the death of Jacob, who carried the birthright, all of it, right to rule, scepter, make the laws, all the birthright. That which was the lawmaker of the universe, the King of Kings, what in the Galatian letter Paul will talk about of the ultimate element in the promise to Abraham, his seed, not seeds, would bless the world. That lineage of the King of Kings would go through Judah. The right to rule, right to make the law, the King of Kings, the lawmaker eternal, comes through Judah. That, without question, Jacob gave to Judah. That is the limited birthright portion of the Jew. That they rejected was their greatest heritage, that through them the King of Kings, Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, would come. But the rest of the birthright, which Ingersoll, the atheist, said, proves the Bible's wrong because it didn't happen to the Jew. It didn't happen to the Jew because it wasn't given to the Jew. It wasn't given to Judah. The rest of the birthright, given unto the sons of Joseph. Verse 2, for Judah prevailed above his brethren. Notice that this is the southern kingdom's chronicle. The Judah kingdom, recognizing Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler. But the birthright was Joseph's. Now, tradition notwithstanding, the birthright went to Israel, the northern kingdom, Ephraim being the dominant tribe. Judah became synonymous with the southern kingdom. Ephraim became synonymous with the northern kingdom. They were carried, the northern kingdom, carrying the birthright, settled, as I said, south of the Caspian Sea in Lake Van. When I was in Stanford, that's in the 1950s, wrote a research paper in which I said the Celts represent those displaced, lost tribes, carriers of the birthright. Now, as archaeology that was just really beginning in the 50s on the heritage of the Celts, if archaeology had traced the Celts and discovered they came over the Himalayas or out of Mongolia, I'd have egg all over my face. But subsequent archaeology has traced the Celts through the Caucasus south to the area right around Lake Van, south of Lake Van in the Caspian Sea. They got their name because Herodotus discovered this band of people north of the Black Sea, north of the Caucasus Mountains, who call themselves Keltoi in the Greek. Well, so what? When they were conquered by the Assyrians, Humra, it's like the Kumani name, you've got to pronounce it with that coughing sound, Humra, was the king of Samaria, the northern kingdom. So when the Assyrians carried them away in bondage, they renamed them. Beat Humri. Beat Kumri. You still have newscasters who will refer to Kumani or Humani because it's hard for Americans to pronounce that. They got a new name. It wasn't until the Behistun rock in Persia was deciphered subsequent to the Rosetta Stone when Rawlinson clambered up that giant rock and deciphered the languages there that we find out what the Persians called these displaced northern kingdom residents settled south of Lake Van and the south of the Caspian Sea. The Persian kingdom, of which Cyrus would later unite the Persians and the Medes and conquer the Assyrians, Persians called them Sakasuni, sons of Isaac. They get new names all the time. In every Bible until the mid-1800s, the apocryphal books were there. The apocryphal books has the last record of these resettled tribes of the north. The Sennacherib plan failed. He settled them as a buffer between the Medes that were pressing in on Assyria. They became mercenaries and fought with the Medes to conquer the Assyrians. They became the Scythians. The Scythians is simply defined as nomadic tribes, on the move all the time, great archers. The Scythians, the Sumerians, which is a etymological takeoff on beat Kumri, the Sumerians, the Sakasuni, and the Maccabees, part of the Apocrypha, they took counsel, would they go back to Israel among themselves and made the decision to not go back but to go through the Caucasus Mountains and settled on the north side north of the Black Sea. In ancient maps, there's still the Israel Pass where they went through. Modern archaeological digs in southern Russia have dug up graveyards where people trace their lineage to the beginning of Jeroboam's kingdom. Don't think them right or know them right. These tribes, having all the characteristics of tribal groups, pressed across northern Europe and settled northern Europe and jumped off into the western nations long before it came to this country, before Columbus came. These Celtic tribes represent the lost tribes. And as I said, with my paper, I'd have egg all over my face. But modern archaeology has traced them back south of the Caspian, south of Lake Van. There's your lost tribes. They have settled northern Europe. They've become the powerful nations. I have hours upon hours of teaching. I have nothing to do with British Israelite theory. I was the one who stepped forth to fight protectively for the worldwide Church of God when it was taken over. Great admirer in Pasadena of the work that Herbert W. Armstrong did, but always openly said he was right in his identifying of the lost tribes. He was wrong in then seeking to return to Old Testament legalistic ways. If I had been an orphan, and as a Christian and a student of the Bible and a blood-bought, ransomed son of God by what Christ has done and discovered my mother was a Jew after I came out of the orphanage, I wouldn't revert to Judaism. And all Christianity points to the return of the Jew to Israel as a fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And they totally neglect the fact that for every promise to the Jew, there are at least 10 or more to the northern tribes, to the birthright people. And to look at the return of the Jew to Israel as proof of God's control over history and ignore the fulfillment of prophecy regarding the northern tribes is to pull blinders over one of the greatest proofs of God's sovereignty over history anywhere in the Bible. It's the Bible that says Judah will go to the house of Israel and with the help of the house of Israel will return to their land. Well, accident of history, Lord Balfour and Lord Rothschild in key positions in the First World War with the British government so that the Balfour Declaration could open for the first time Israel for the return of the Jew. Wouldn't have happened. Britain, United States, the leading Celtic nations of the world, inextricably tied to Israel, have nothing to do with politics. Try to extricate all you want. They will be together at the end. To neglect the prophecies for these northern tribes is to wear blinders and let the devil win the battle because he immediately saw the truth. It was archaeology in the mid-1800s that was bringing forth the truth to allow the discovery of who these tribes were, and to let the devil move in with a cultic idiocy and thus make people afraid to even deal with the subject. I'm a teacher of the Bible. Tell me how you're going to interpret 2 Chronicles 5 or 1 Chronicles 5 and Genesis 49. The birthright was split. Now, I'm teaching ad infinitum, it seems, on the network. Christians turned off by their unscholarly and cowardly preachers who want to dismiss Gene Scott as a British Israelite. I'm the greatest opponent to that idiocy of legalism. But I'm a teacher of God's faithfulness to His Word. And He kept His Word to the sons of Joseph as He kept His Word to the sons of Judah. To neglect it is to miss maybe the greatest proof other than the resurrection of the veracity of Christianity. I'm a teacher of the truth. And you need to get yourself an internet computer or a satellite and tune in on the faith-building teaching concerning these lost tribes and the place that they have in last-day prophecy. It was also in the Maccabees of the Apocrypha that we find the high priest at Jerusalem recognizing that the Spartans, Celtic Greeks, the Spartans or Celtic Macedonians, the Spartans were their brethren with a common heritage to Abraham. Don't think I'm right. I know I'm right. The scepter and the law went to Judah. The birthright went to Ephraim and the sons of Joseph. Tell me God is blinded in prophecy and would deal with all these other kingdoms in the image of Nebuchadnezzar and leave out the greatest kingdom the world has ever seen, the British colonial empire. The heart and soul, if you trace the Celtic movements of the Ephraimites and Manasseh, the heritage of this United States and its origins, the Plymouth colony coming right from the place that you can trace, Manasseh and Denmark, where Dan would put its mark even Iceland, traced to Benjamin. These tribes that came out of the area north of the Black Sea, you can trace their history in the Celtic archaeology and history. God kept his word. What other nation in the history pushed every other nation back and has never lost a major war? Britain and its colonies, the United States. Why are these two nations so tied together? Anglicized America. God still controls history. And to neglect this, how many sermons have you heard from your pastor on Amos? How many sermons have you heard from your pastor on Hosea? How many sermons have you heard on these minor prophets? They're neglected in the preaching from the pulpits because they were prophets to the northern kingdom. They were prophecies concerning the birthright people. Take nothing away from God's protective care of the Jew. He's kept his word with them. He divorced the northern kingdom. He just punished and scattered the Jew. I suggest you tune in on the homepage and look into this.